Well, it's another week, and I hope you had a good weekend, and we're already through Monday, headed toward Tuesday. Glad to have you along tonight. We have an outstanding program on, as we always try to bring you each night. Webster Griffin Tarpley is back this evening for a lengthy conversation, and you better sit tight and hang on, because you're going to hear the truth, and hear it in a most marvelously presented fashion. He, of course, is an activist and an historian, best known for, well, I think many of you know this book. It's George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography, published back in 1992. It became an immediate underground classic. It still is at www.tarpley.net. Webster also co-authored American Leviathan, Administration Fascism Under the Bush Regime, 1991, which identified many tendencies which have become all too prominent today. He is an expert on international terrorism with decades of experience studying such. He directed the study, Who Killed Aldo Moro, which was commissioned by a member of the Italian government and published in Rome in 1978. Aldo Moro was an ex-prime minister of Italy who was murdered by the so-called Red Brigades, who were ultimately found out to be a front for a fascist state terror group. Against Oligarchy, a collection of Tarpley's essays and speeches, appeared on the Internet in 1996. He also wrote Surviving the Cataclysm in 1999, an analysis of the world financial crisis at that time, and that was 7 years ago. Parts of these works and all the unauthorized biography can be viewed on the net at tarpley.net, T-A-R-P-L-E-Y. Webster Tarpley has appeared on innumerable programs, including CNN Crossfire, Charlie Rose, and cable access television all across North America. He is back with us tonight, and his newest book, as many of you know, is truly a masterpiece of an expose on September 11th, entitled 9/11, Synthetic Terror Made in the USA. And we're most honored to have him back on the program for another visit tonight. Hello, Mr. T.
Thank you, Jeff. That's a wonderful introduction. I'm very grateful.
Well, it's my pleasure. And if I might just start out, let's just jump right into things. There was another story that came rumbling along this morning, and I put it together, and it's up there actually in the second news block at Rents.com now. And the title simply says, Bush Administration Secret Panel Sells Control of Six Major United States Ports. And I'm sure you probably heard about this today. It's not a surprise. The bid went to a company in the United Arab Emirates, all poised now and ready to take over significant operations in six American ports as part of a corporate sale, leaving a country with alleged ties to the September 11 hijackers and whatever they really were, with influence over a maritime industry considered vulnerable to terrorism, and is it ever, with only one or two containers out of every 100 coming into our ports of entry. It is basically an open door. But the key to this story was that the Dubai Corporation, Dubai Ports World is the actual name of them, won the approval from a so-called secretive U.S. government panel, whatever the hell that means, that considers security risks of foreign companies buying or investing in American industry. So, once again, all this talk about keeping jobs at home and everything else, just so much hot air from the folks at 1600 Pennsylvania.
Yes, I think so. And I haven't had a chance to study this particular problem very much at all, but what I do understand is that the company in the United Arab Emirates has some kind of a link back to the Bush machine. In other
sure.
words, it's essentially Bush's picked panel of stooges and oligarchs who are deliberating that they're going to sell this. Now, I suppose if they'd sold it to Halliburton, that would have been one thing. If they'd sold it to this Kellogg, Brown, and Root, that would have been another thing. They could have sold it to one of these other notorious proprietaries or a
right.
private military firm. Naturally, the United Arab Emirates, this is simply globalized capital. And, of course, from my point of view, it's not so much the United Arab Emirates that are linked to September 11th, but the Bush administration, and in particular those rogue networks in the Defense Department, the CIA, the DIA, the NSA, and
right.
of course reaching into Bush's White House. And of course he's now the eager spokesman, the guy who turned the whole government over to the rogue network coup forces on September 11th, and has been acting as their spokesman ever since. But I guess that is, of course, a sign of the times. I guess one theme that we ought to consider is just the idea that I can share it with you because it's actually the enemy's own timeline. I came across this in the mid-1980s in the Library of Congress. It's a book by Samuel Huntington on the potential for conflict in American society.
Mm-hmm.
And what he says there is that he thinks the second decade of the 21st century, so that means the period of 2010
mm-hmm.
to 2020,
mm-hmm.
is going to be marked by a tremendous crisis, some combination of a crisis of legitimacy of the form of government, a military defeat, perhaps, and then some kind of economic, financial, natural resources
right.
event. And
well,
I
hell, we've already suffered a military defeat, and so that's in the books.
But maybe something more spectacular, which that would be the Iranian possibility. So if we're looking towards this, I think it's good for people to look into the future, and instead of only looking at the recent past or sort of side to side across the present, look ahead now. There is every indication now that there will be this cataclysmic political crisis, and I think the 2010-2020,
sure.
that's a pretty good time frame for it, and I think it's going to be associated with the fall of the dollar as a reserve currency, and that should make us shudder, because the fall of a reserve currency, the most recent example that we've had of it,
mm-hmm.
is what we saw between 1914 and 1945 when
mm-hmm.
the British pound was dethroned as the main reserve currency in the world by the U.S. dollar. And, of course, that period is the period of two world wars and a world economic depression, fascism, communism, and a whole other series of social dislocations. And somehow that we're now approaching a period of that type, I think that's what we have to think of.
I agree, and if I might just toss in, I don't think we need to wait until 2010 necessarily. There's a lot of stammering and yammering about 2008 already and what's going to happen then. And then, of course, on the more esoteric side of things, there is the alleged Mayan calendar with its 2012 end times, or at least they may have run out of rock when they carved the calendar, but there's that 2012 date that looms larger. Watch now, you think, folks, that Y2K was a big deal? Watch the drumbeat for 2012. Just keep that in mind as we get closer to it. But yes, I agree, Webster, that things are headed towards some kind of a major fracture, if not cataclysm, to one degree or another. It can't continue. I mean, the national debt is a joke. This country is hopelessly bankrupt. It'll never be redeemed. What may happen, of course, is the Fed and the rest of the crooks who run things, decide to declare it a loss, a total loss, erase the debts, and start the game all over again. Who knows?
Well, actually, the cancellation of debt, that is some sort of a universal debt jubilee, has definite possibilities, but I can't
jubilee.
Imagine how any of these characters would do it. Maybe that's another thing, is we've had the end of an era. Now, I guess we're here tonight to talk about Iran, and I hope that's going to be the main
correct,
issue. But
correct.
Just as a kind of a preparation, this Greenspan era at the Federal Reserve, this, of course, has been a disaster, right? Greenspan was the guy, you remember, he came in 1987. He immediately raised the federal discount rate one full percentage point, and with
mm-hmm.
that, he provoked the crash of 1987.
Single-handedly, almost.
By full point. That was
yeah.
tremendous surprise. But now we've got this guy Bernanke. Now, we'd have to put it together. We've just had the announcement that the U.S. Merchandise trade deficit for last year has reached a new high, $725 or $26 billion. That's it's a colossal sum.
Colossal.
The year before was approximately $600 billion.
Uh-huh.
So this is a 17.5% increase. So it means that whereas the U.S. indebtedness towards the rest of the world at the beginning of last year was thought to be, according to the London Economist, $3.3 trillion, it's now up to a full $4 trillion.
Right.
And by now it's approaching $4.5 trillion just on the basis of this calculation alone. And now we have this guy Bernanke, and this is where you can get an idea which way things are going. Bernanke he's got this nickname, Helicopter Ben. I don't know if you've heard this.
No, I haven't.
Oh, he's the head of the Federal Reserve, Helicopter Ben.
Well, I know who he is, but I didn't know it was Helicopter Ben.
He believes in the potential of flooding the system with liquidity. In other words, he seems to have hyperinflation written all over him. He got this name because he was told that, you know, he was facing the theoretical problem of a new world depression. And if you had a new world depression, in other words, a big deflation worldwide, how would you get out of it? And he said, well, we can simply print dollars and we'll send out helicopters to drop the dollars on everybody's lawn. They'll go out and buy things and then we'll reflate and we'll get out of a depression that way.
I missed that one. Hold on.
Helicopter Ben.
Yeah, I kind of view the guy as a fellow who was brought in to oversee the final act and just kind of take the heat and take his money and then go when it's over. I don't know. I think you're right. The end of an era is upon us. I think you're quite right. We're back in just a minute with the remarkable Webster Griffin Tarpley. Don't go away. You know, my friend, it always irks me every time, and we all do it, when we refer to that that vile, hideous parasite as the Federal Reserve. I mean, it's one of the biggest misnomers in economic history. It should be the Private Reserve or something else. But these crooks and gangsters have been raping America for forever, since they've been on duty, so to speak.
Jeff, the one thing that they've never been able to put together in this country is a real roaring hyperinflation. And now, as you say, Bernanke seems to be a possible candidate for doing this. And if he does, he'll be building on Greenspan's legacy. I just want to mention a couple of things about this, because it has to do with one of my main topics, which is this Iranian oil bourse. Yeah. And the
Bernanke will not be doing anything on his own, folks, okay? This is orchestrated.
Oh, of course. He's you know, it's a committee of finance oligarchs, and that's even how it's set up. I mean, that's exactly what you see. We've already got a pretty serious commodity inflation going on. If you compare where the commodity markets were at the beginning of February to where they were in September, you will see that lead has gone up 55%, gold has gone up 22%. Gold, indeed, is at about a 25-year high. Copper is up 44% since September. Aluminum, 50%. Tin, 30%. Zinc, 100%. And, of course, we've got oil at a very high price. Copper, the copper price is actually the all-time record, was reached this past month.
Huh.
And is at an 18-year high. Now, some people will come along and say, well, that means we have peak oil, peak lead, peak gold, peak copper, peak aluminum, peak tin, zinc, and so forth. And I would have to say no, or peak housing, because we have that too. It's none of that. It's simply that what this expresses is a general decline of paper money in general,
correct,
for sure,
right,
and of the dollar in particular. And then if you look at Bernanke again, he seems to already be swaying in the direction of printing yet more money, even on top of what Greenspan has done. And you wonder, if you put that together with the possible closing of the Straits of Hormuz, or the interdiction of oil traffic in the Gulf, which I think was one of our main topics for tonight, you can see that this is already a very sick organism that has no ability to defend itself against any outside shocks. And I think this is why the incalculable folly and irresponsibility of the Bush neocon administration comes into, I think, very sharp relief. Because if you have an economy that sick, with, again, a $725 billion trade deficit, and if you owe the world a total of $4 to $4.5 trillion, you're the world's biggest debtor nation,
right,
you are not in a position to antagonize large parts of the world by bombing Iran, by filling the clouds over the Indian Ocean with radioactive debris, getting yourself into big fights with Russia, China, or anybody else. And yet that is what these again, neocon fascist madmen, is the only thing I can call them. That seems to be what they're determined to do.
You can throw the word Zionist in there.
Yes, that too, of course. Maybe we should we dive in on the Mohammed cartoons?
Sure, I would. Let's do that. And I would also just hasten to add that, in my humble estimation, this economy is terminal. I don't see a rehabilitation for it. I think what you've said is correct. I think we see hyperinflation ahead. Ultimately, it's going to destroy what's left of the American middle class, which is, of course, the design. This is a financial cataclysm. And every city, every county, and every state government in this country is essentially bankrupt. And you can take it from one end to the other, internationally, down to the local level. It's over. That's the way I look at it.
The one good thing about hyperinflation, of course, is that debt tends to fare very poorly. Bonded debt, all kinds of debt, simply get wiped out. And again, the kind of hyperinflation I'm talking about, maybe we tell a couple of examples. The most famous example is in Germany from 1922 to 1923. This was
That's called wheelbarrow inflation.
It was British economic warfare against Germany because of the Rapallo Accords, although there was an even worse hyperinflation in Hungary in the very last years of the Second World War. They got up to something like 6 trillion to 1. But it's a situation where if you're going to go to a restaurant and buy a meal, you want to pay the bill at the beginning rather than the end, because if you wait to the end, it'll cost you 10 times more. And if you get into a slow lane at the checkout, you're going to be in big trouble, because you'll pay 3 or 4 or 5 times more if you're several minutes late to the checkout.
And it's happening in Zimbabwe right now. Same kind of thing.
Well, I wasn't aware of that. But again, this has never been seen in the United States in quite that form.
No.
And it could be. And I think it's definitely a possibility. So we have to think about this for the period ahead.
We have a break coming up in just a minute. Then we have a long segment, so let's hold off on getting started on that. And for those of you who have been following Mugabe's antics in Zimbabwe, you'll know that inflation is, of course, absolutely rampant there. Same kind of thing. And these are all being done carefully and deliberately to punish the people. That's the way it works. We will see what happens. We're going to talk with Webster about the cartoons and the great cartoon outrage that swept through the European Muslim community. Who was behind it? Lots of articles coming out about that. The picture seems to be rather clear now. We'll come back and do that and much more with Webster, Griffin, Tarpley in just a couple minutes. Let me invite all of you to drop by Rents.com. That's R-E-N-S-E, Rents.com. 24/7 for real news from all over the world for you to better make your own decisions about what you think is going on. Okay, and we are right back with you. Webster Griffin Tarpley is my guest tonight. All right, it's cartoon time. Webster, let's see what we've got.
Well, let's start with what we have just learned about Bush pre-Iraq war, just to refresh our memories on how these things work. We've now got another Downing Street memorandum leak, which tells us about a conversation between Tony Blair and Bush in the White House sometime before the Iraq war actually broke out. And this is released by this guy Philippe Sand of the University College London, I guess, Queen's Counsel. And he says that the conversation in question, Bush says, if we can't do the war any other way, we'll send a U-2 over Iraq painted in United Nations colors, and then if they shoot that down, that will be in a violation. Now, you have to realize he's willing to get U.S. pilots killed in the U-2 in order to get the provocation that he wants. So we have to be thinking in terms of a provocation, because what we've been looking at, what I personally have been looking at since the middle of last summer, say July, is this question of the new 9/11 through some kind of a terrorist provocation, and then the attack on Iran, but also the possible attack on Syria. And this, we simply have been poised on the brink of this now for quite a number of months. So now comes this strange little reactionary right-wing newspaper, Jyllands-Posten in Denmark. And they print these cartoons, and then it's taken over by a magazine in Norway, and then it's printed by La Stampa of Turin and François.
There were about 10 or 11 publications that kind of picked this up almost a whole bunch.
And the interesting thing here is that it's clear to all that we're on the brink of the attack on Iran. And you can see that what they're attempting to do with this, and it is very clever, is an adjustment. And that is to say, in the case of the Iraq war, we had the U.S. and the British saying attack, and then we had France and Germany. We had Schroeder still in Chancellor of Germany and Chirac of France saying, no, it's wrong to do this, it's not the right time, or whatever it is, but always advancing some kind of an opposition to it. Now, the leadership of Europe has been destroyed. It's been destroyed by those French riots of last November, which were themselves staged. They were orchestrated. These were old Nazi networks that had converted into Islam under the guidance of NATO intelligence. And we've also had this little incident where Schröder fell from power. He could have really stayed on, it seems to me, but the people inside the SPD were not willing to fight for him in a way that they could have, his own party. So now we've got this rather pathetic puppet, Mrs. Merkel, who will not be able to put up any resistance at all to Tony Blair and the neocons. So we have
poor Germany. For such a long time, such a magnificent country with a heritage of science, of literature, and look at it now.
Yeah. Well, of course, the political leadership, I mean, if we want to think back to somebody like, you know, the Emperor William II, this was, the leadership has been to go no further than that, right, to not even pick some more obvious ones.
Sure.
They have had there's a problem of political development that has to do with the fact that the national unity came so late, and that when it did, it came under purely authoritarian auspices with Bismarck, and then this crazy Kaiser, and then, of course, downhill from them. But absolutely, I think the German leaders post-World War II, they have been, we might say, the best of a bad lot in terms of the Western world, at least in some ways. But now there's the point is that there's no more resistance. So we have now Western Europe, Europe in general, adrift. So what do they do? They're able, the U.S. and the British, and I'll try to show in some detail how they did this, because it's fascinating to see. They concocted a provocation, a psyop, right? Psychological warfare operation, synthetic, artificial from the very beginning, that would somehow put Europe into the firing line, where the U.S. and the British could stay in the background. Tony Blair and Bush would not be the protagonists of this new crisis, but it would be the smaller countries. Look who's taken it on the chin. Look who's gotten their embassy burned down. Norway, Sweden, Denmark, France has been under attack. Germany has been under attack. Spain has been under attack. So now the Europeans are on the receiving end of this fake explosion of the war of civilizations, of exactly what the neocons and what the Cheniacs have wanted all along. And it seems to me that the obvious goal of this is to dragoon, to recruit Europe into the war that's coming, because this is also essential, because we're now looking at something rather ambitious, and it's going to take additional resources. I think they can see that. So you're going to need, more than ever, the NATO logistical base, first of all, the German railways, the Italian ports, the Italian air bases, the French military forces, if you can get them. You've got to get Turkey, and that's not easy to do, but if you can add the NATO pressure on Turkey, it may be possible to try to get Turkey involved, although all signs so far are Turkey is saying no. So they want to be able to count on the immense resources and indeed money of Western Europe in order to go into this. And again, one of the governments, the key one, really, Germany, the most important single country, you had Schröder, and now you've got this pathetic kind of neocon light.
She's incredible.
Yeah, she is a pathetic and I think a wretched figure. Well, let's go back. Let's go back to May 5th through May 8th of last year, 2005, at this place called Tegernsee. Now, Tegernsee is a lake in Bavaria, and I've been fortunate enough to be there once or twice. So there's a hotel called the Sofitel Hotel in Rottach Egern. So on the shores of this Tegernsee Lake. And here we have a meeting of the Bilderberger Group. Now, I guess people know about the Bilderberger Group, right? Founded by the genocidalist Prince Philip of Britain, the guy who wants to come back as a virus and kill people to solve the problem of overpopulation.
Just mind blows me still to this day that the guy would be so, you know, he thinks that way, but to be so stupid to have vocalized it in public.
Yeah. It would be hard to find a quotation from Hitler that says it quite that bluntly.
I completely concur with you.
And then, of course, Prince Bernard of Holland. Now, this is Prince Bernard of Lippe-Biesterfeld, a prince of the Holy Roman Empire and therefore of Germany. And this is the guy who married the Queen of the Netherlands. He, of course, had been a member of the Nazi SA, Stormtroopers, and the SS. And in the SS, he was in the upper part where you had to be a nobleman to get in, the so-called Reiter SS.
All right, hold on right there. This is a fascinating story and a look at history as we live it and our immediate past through the eyes of a man that you will not hear often in this world. So pay close attention. Much to learn and much ahead with Webster Griffin Tarpley. Let's go.
Well, we've got the Bilderberger group there for meeting in Bavaria at this picturesque lake in the early May of 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a group of the finance oligarchs, top government officials, people that are important in the world of culture, a lot of heads of state, heads of government. For example, the Queen of the Netherlands was there. You had David Rockefeller. You had various Rothschilds. You had, very important, the Secretary General of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, Jaap Hoop de Scheffer. He's Dutch, and he's the NATO General Secretary. So he's the head of the NATO bureaucracy near Brussels. I don't have the complete list of all of the politicians that were there, but it's a long list. It's basically a very significant cross-section of the top levels of this oligarchical ruling elite of the Western world. In particular, you've got Michael Ledeen, Richard Perl, and William Luty. And I think this is important because these are three people that share a fanatical devotion to the Iraq War, desire to widen that to an Iran and Syria war as well. And interestingly enough, they're all facing criminal indictment. Ledeen in the question of the Niger yellow cake forgeries, right? Mm-hmm. The thing that was behind the Valerie Plame scandal.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Perl is up to his neck in the fraudulent bankruptcy and embezzlement case against Lord Conrad Black, because he was on the board of directors of the Hollinger Corporation or one of these other holding companies that Black had. And then Luty, who was in the Pentagon with Feith and Wolfowitz and the rest of them. So here we have the cooking of the Iraq intelligence, the Valerie Plame question, Ahmed Chalabi, and so forth. So we have this entire group meeting, and one of the participants is then a certain Anders Eldrep of Denmark. He's the head of the Danish oil and natural gas company. So Anders Eldrep is a participant. He's a Bilderberger regular. He's been there for 5 years. He is the husband of Merete Eldrep. And again, it's Meretelderep. So this Merete Eldrep is the managing director of JP Politikens Hus. So that's the holding company, the publishing firm that owns Julens Posten, that published the Mohammed cartoons.
There's the link.
And and this Politiken also. So it's a leading right-wing neocon publishing house in Denmark. Now that, I think that's already significant because the Bilderberger group, I think sometimes it's overrated. What I think they're good for is they are a place where a preconceived line is presented to a group of people who are going to help to carry it out.
It's good to hear you say that, Webster, because so many people misunderstand. They think policy is actually forged there, and it's not. Not to anything I can discern, anyway.
I don't think so. I think the policy has got to be made by the time you start this meeting. And I suppose if there were grave objections, this might register somehow. But generally, I think the stuff is all decided somehow at a higher level in meetings that are quite informal, that you never hear about, that don't have an official list, that can't be penetrated by enterprising journalists or what have you. Just give a couple of examples. The way I see the Bilderberger in it's something like this. It's to plan a more or less specific action in the next year or so. The Kyoto, Japan meeting of the Bilderberg in 1975 was supposedly where Gianni Agnelli of Fiat, right, the head of this broken down automobile company that's now in the city where the Olympics are being held. And
How can it still be in business? But anyway,
It's still in business. And,
I know.
I'm sure they could, you know, with proper management, they could make good cars because they have, you know, design and all that.
They haven't yet.
All right. So this is where Gianni Agnelli presented Jimmy Carter as the next president of the United States to the assembled oligarchy. So there was a specific operation. Let's make Carter the next president. More important for my purposes is the 1973 Bilderberger. They generally have these things in the springtime. 73, I think, was in March in this place called Saltsjöbaden, Sweden. It's a suburb of Stockholm where you have the Grand Hotel, among other things. So this was the one where they said, we're going to have an oil crisis. We're going to have a fake Middle East war organized by Henry Kissinger, and then we're going to pump up the price of oil as much as the traffic will bear. Because remember, the 1973 oil crisis was a fake. It was a fraud. There was never an interruption of supply. The supply, indeed, was probably greater than it had ever been, but it provided this opportunity to go into the New York speculative markets and bid it up, which they did, to the tune of 400%. That was key to saving the dollar, saving the U.S. banking system, and so forth. So it would seem to me that that one of the themes of this Bilderberger group, and it's difficult to confirm it because, of course, they're secretive, would have been the need to attack Iran and the need to get Europe involved. And I think that's something that's well within the capabilities of the Bilderberger. Now, there's an even more specific aspect. The guy at Jyllands-Posten, who ordered the publication of these cartoons, is a certain Fleming Rose.
Right.
So Fleming Rose doesn't really look like a typical arts and crafts figure. He had been the correspondent in Moscow and apparently knew Russian pretty well. Now, that would indicate something more, right? Maybe some kind of a background that might point more in the direction of intelligence agencies or something like that. Be that as it may, what we know for sure about Fleming Rose is that he's a great friend of Daniel Pipes. And this tells us a lot. Now, Daniel Pipes, yet another of the neocon fascist madmen, and he really is a prize case. This guy is the head of Campus Watch. And if you're a professor, if you have a kind word for the Arabs, for the PLO, for any Islamic cause of any kind, then what Daniel Pipes wants to do is to send spies into your classroom and write down or tape or film the things you say, and then put you up on the website and try to get you fired, try to get your tenure revoked. It's a neo-McCarthyite organization of the most scurrilous kind. And that's Daniel Pipes. Now, he is a nepotist in the sense that his father was Richard Pipes. Back in 1976, Bush the Elder decided that he wanted to challenge the CIA estimates about the Soviet Union and what their intentions were. So he did what the neocons generally do. They create a fake parallel CIA outside of the real one because the real one is not bad enough for them. I'm sure it's very bad, but it's not bad enough for the things that they want to do. So in this case, Daniel Pipes of Harvard became, and he was a Russian studies expert, became the head of this, or that he became the central figure, I guess we'd have to say, the chairman, the president of Team B, the quarterback of Team B, who then came up with this inflammatory notion about the window of vulnerability and all the terrible things the Soviets were preparing. So this is now his son, and it's fair to say that his son is where he is because of this nepotistic connection. Bush loves Daniel Pipes, so much so that he wanted to make him a member of the board of the United States Institute of Peace, which is an arm of the State Department, and its goal is not peace, but something else. It's kind of Orwellian there, too. Pipes was a candidate to become the head of, a member of the board of the United States Institute of Peace, but he couldn't get through the Senate confirmation because he was so discredited as an extremist, a racist, a bigot, a hate monger, and so forth. So in 2003, I guess it was, he received a recess appointment. And I don't know whether he's still there, but he may still be there. It depends on when the recess appointment ran out. Now, this is a guy, when Daniel Pipes was put on this board, a very moderate organization called the Arab American Institute here in Washington said that Daniel Pipes was an example of hatred and bigotry and a bizarre obsession with all things Arab and Muslim. So after Fleming Rice went to see Daniel Pipes, he wrote a glowing article about it, and it's clear what they talked about, because he tells you. Fleming Rose, the guy who put the cartoons in the Danish newspaper, writes, this is October 2004, Pipes is surprised that there isn't greater alarm in Europe over the challenge that Islam represents, thanks to falling rates of fertility and a weakened sense of its own history and culture. So it's clear what they talked about, how to develop an anti-Muslim, anti-Arab backlash in Europe that would then get Europe back into its usual position as water boy for the U.S. Aggressive intent vis-a-vis these Arab states, or in this case, Iran, the leading Islamic state, I guess at this point, we'd have to say, is Iran, so they would therefore be the target. Now, there's even a third connection. So far, we've had the Bilderberger and the fact that the woman who runs this company that's ultimately responsible for the newspaper, her husband is a Bilderberger stalwart. We've got the connection of Fleming Rose to Pipes. There's also the fact that this newspaper is somehow in the orbit of a think tank called CEPOS, and it's a new think tank, Center for Political Studies in Denmark, and it came into existence last year in the springtime. And this is something where the think tank is close to the Jyllandsposten in terms of, you know, personnel exchanges and so forth. And then we look at the board of directors of CEPOS and its advisory board, and who we find there, yet another neocon, in this case, the top one, George Shultz, the most senior figure, the guy who seems to me to be at any given time the spokesman of the U.S. oligarchical elite, the guy who chose Bush, chose the cabinet, chose Wolfowitz, chose Condi, chose all of them, chose Schwarzenegger, chose all of these people to be where they are, the kingmaker, and therefore I think sort of the informal spokesman, the primus inter pares of the U.S. banking establishment and oligarchy in general.
Wow, all right, perfect timing. We'll pause and come right back and continue our conversation. A conversation with Webster Griffin Tarpley, Iran, a prelude to war? We'll see. All right, Mr. T, let's go ahead. Lots to talk about. Fascinating so far, and laid out, I might say, just brilliantly, succinctly, and if you folks can't follow it, you're not listening. Go ahead.
And of course, there is this this article, which you were one of the first people in the world to post. I think that's an important public service. So it's all there, the Mohammed cartoons recruiting Europe for Bush's attack on Iran. So the idea is that the Jyllandsposten is connected to the Bilderberger, the editor is connected to Daniel Pipes and the neocons, and this other thing, CEPOS, right, George Shultz has got his tentacles in there. I guess the other thing I'd just like to say is there's so much propaganda about freedom of the press and freedom and liberty of expression. I know Denmark rather well. I've done quite a number of things in Denmark over the years. I've given a lecture on one occasion to the Royal Danish General Staff, right, the military leaders. That was in 1983. The one thing you would know about this is like these, it's a typical small European monarchy, like Holland, like Belgium, like Norway, like Sweden. They're all monarchies. In most of these places, the monarch is the head of the state church or something like that, and the leader of society. I know in Denmark, I used to know a classical musician, and you kid her about the drottning, right, the queen. The drottning of Denmark is this queen.
Uh-huh.
And they would say if you ever insulted the queen or if the queen just didn't like you, you were finished as a classical musician in Denmark. You just couldn't go anywhere. And on one occasion, some friends of mine went into the streets with a placard saying something nasty about the drottning, and they got a visit from a group called the PET, P-E-T, and you can look them up. The P-E-T is the political intelligence and counterintelligence. It's Politiets-Efterretjenste, and there it is up on the internet. You can take a look at it. Very sinister, very stealthy. Nobody's ever heard of it. And they're all monarchists. And the question they had is, why are you attacking the queen? Why are you attacking the drottning here in the streets? Oh. And they have new legislation, just to round out the point. If you go to the PET, P-E-T, intelligence agency website, they'll say that they have new Danish legislation on terrorism, which expands the scope of the intelligence service. So the PET can now do not just things that lead to criminal cases, but other more offensive initiatives. What would be a more offensive initiative? I guess it's this. And the PET is much more like British MI5 than even the FBI. In other words, their mandate is absolutely pervasive. And the other thing about Denmark that you have to see is not only you have all this, but there's a psychological warfare board. All of these Scandinavian countries, Sweden is the most notorious case. They have a psychological warfare board that has power to plant stories, suppress stories, anytime they want for national security reasons. So the Danish Psychological Warfare Board.
Whatever that means.
Well, they would have had the right to shut this stuff down if they'd wanted to, or put it in if they wanted to.
Well, we've had that same mechanism here since the 1950s. But
in these cases, these are... They're official government organisms that
up front, above board.
Everybody knows about it.
No,
it's not an informal system like the Anglo, well, at least like the U.S. one, as far as I know. I'm sure there's an official U.S. Aspect. So you have all this stuff going on. And then, of course, if you just look at Denmark, Denmark has been a British satellite for 200 years. The last time Denmark was independent was when they had their own fleet. And that was destroyed by Lord Horatio Nelson, right? The guy who won the Battle of Trafalgar.
Uh-huh.
We've just had the 200th of his death, right, this past year.
Right.
He came in with a sneak attack and destroyed and burned the Danish fleet. And he was asked, why did you do it? And he said, oh, well, it was the only mass of warships left in Europe that could have fallen into the hands of Napoleon, so I had to make sure that I destroyed them. The Danes have never recovered from that. They've never been independent. And therefore, when you see something coming out of Denmark, it's like saying Tony Blair did it.
Uh-huh.
So I think maybe that puts the whole thing in perspective.
It does bring a very sharp and refined line to it all. I had no idea the connection. Interesting.
Now, the other side of it is on the Arab side. Now, my documentation here is less, and it's a series of hints. But if you remember in the Iranian Revolution, you had this phenomenon called the Rent-a-Mob back in 1978-79.
Right.
It was possible to put together with, a little bit of money or a few threats or a few words here in different intelligence services, you could assemble a fairly significant mob and carry on a riot with very little preparation. And it looks to me like that's what has been done now in places like Lebanon, Syria, Iran, and elsewhere. In other words, that there's pre-concert, there's a conspiracy in the Western side. We've been talking about that in some detail. But that there's also a parallel effort being made by whatever the British have, whatever the U.S. has, whatever the Mossad has in places like Damascus or Tehran. And so, and indeed, there may be political forces in Tehran who think that this is a great thing.
Right.
I think they're very wrong. But, it's clear that there's very little spontaneous about this. In other words, the irony of this whole thing is people are ranting and raving about freedom and freedom of the press and journalistic expression. What the whole thing expresses is the pervasive control of very sinister secret intelligence agencies over the reality that we see in the world. To me, that's the overwhelming point. This is all the work of various kinds of spooks.
Agreed.
Of all different kinds. Now, that would then have the lesson, I think, for somebody, if you happen to be an Arab or a Muslim, the question is, this is a provocation. This is designed to be the red flag for the bull. This is designed to elicit riots. It's designed to cause a backlash then in Europe. They want to bring to the surface the racist and colonialist heritage of Europe, right? The anti-foreigner sentiment there, which is very strong, and make that go off the deep end and to the point where it's going to be easier for these countries to either vote money or troops or diplomatic support for the attack on Iran, which is now pretty much upon us. So my word to the Muslims and the Arabs is you cannot accept provocation. You've got to realize what is being done, and don't go for the red flag, right? Go for the matador. Don't go for the cape. Go for the matador. And in that regard, I tried to put in my article, the guy who's been the clearest on this is Mahathir Mohamad, right, the former prime minister of Malaysia, who did a very good job defending his country back in 1998 when he put in currency controls, and generally the Malaysian currency fared better. Malaysia in general fared much better than anybody else in that big Asian contagion crisis, so-called. And what Mahathir has been saying for many years is, if you don't like the way the U.S. and the British are running the world, then do something about that. And the way to do that is dump the dollar. Right? Set up some kind of a parallel alternative monetary system. We could discuss the details. And then you really will have struck something important. You will have done damage to the ability of the U.S. and the British to manipulate the world in the way that we've seen. And I would say that's the answer, ultimately. In other words, don't buy into this this dynamic, right? That you have these scurrilous cartoons. They're also the cartoons themselves are idiotic. They're not clever. They're not funny. They're not worth it. And it's a very obscure publication. And realize that be it the cartoons and the spread of the cartoons and the riots on the other side is all fixed. It's all fake, hoaxed up.
Correct.
And,
how successful was this operation?
I'm afraid it's been quite successful in the sense that you now have all kinds of people. If you watch the German news, they're saying, well, we're thinking now we're going to have retaliation against different countries. If they attack the European Union, we're going to cut off aid. And this is significant because the European Union aid budget in Germany is percentage-wise much higher than the U.S. The U.S. is pretty much a vagrant in these matters. I think you'll be able to show, you can test it in a couple of ways. One is with the Hamas question. There's an agitation on the part of the Israelis and others that if Hamas refuses to accept Israel's right to exist, then the European Union should cut off all aid. Now, the problem with that is that's genocide, because the Palestinians are kept in this Bantustan ghetto of Gaza and the West Bank. They have no jobs. They're living, in effect, off foreign aid, such a life as they have. If you cut that off, you're basically saying, kill them. And, of course, there's also the irony. If Israel wants Hamas to, or the PLO state, to recognize Israel, then why doesn't Israel recognize the PLO state? If you want to do this, do it reciprocally. Then you might have a case. But that's never the question. So if Israel says, we want you to recognize us and renounce terrorism, the Palestinian state can say, we would like you to recognize us, please, in decent borders, and we would like you also to stop your targeted assassinations, which to us are terrorism.
Right.
So the question is, what will Europe do on that?
Mm-hmm.
That would be one.
That's a good question. All right. Back in a minute. Webster Griffin Tarpley, been a success, and we are looking now forward to what's the next step, Webster?
Well, the question then becomes the aggression against Iran. Now, I say successful. Again, we'll measure it with the European response to Hamas. Will they, for example, cut off their aid?
Uh-huh.
And then there's how would they, for example, act in the UN Security Council when it comes down to the vote on economic sanctions or indeed a vote on actual military action. Now,
go ahead, please.
I would extend this. Remember that I still see Putin as a force of resistance,
mm-hmm.
and I see the Chinese as a force of resistance, right? The Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Maybe we can talk about that in a minute.
Yeah.
I think the important thing to see right now is the timetable and the reason. Vladimir Zhirinovsky is this well-known Russian maverick politician who said his business is saying outrageous things. He's the head of the Liberal Democratic Party of Russia, which was a satellite of Yeltsin as long as Yeltsin was around, and I guess it's a satellite of Putin. He says the attack will come, the attack on Iran will come on the 28th of March, which happens to be the day of the Israeli elections.
Yep, yep.
Before Sharon himself was incapacitated, he had ordered the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, to be ready to attack Iran in March. And I would propose the deadline that things revolve around. Now, what doesn't mean that this is the date of the attack, but the 20th of March, because this is the opening of this epoch-making Iran oil bourse, right? The oil exchange in Iran, where for the first time really since 1945,
mm-hmm.
you'll be able to buy and sell oil using a currency other than the dollar. And in this case, it's going to be the euro. Now, I don't know if we've talked about this. I guess we haven't really done justice to it because it seems to me this is in some way the theme that sums up the entire world situation. If you're looking at world domination is decided in the short run and the medium run, I guess by military forces
mm-hmm.
and by hegemony of that type. But as soon as you look into the medium run and especially into the longer run, then it's a matter of economics.
Always
that's
economics.
Where the military forces come from. Mm-hmm. And there we have this question of the dollar. The dollar has been the world reserve currency since 1944, and it has, since 1971, it's had a kind of a residual world reserve currency role, meaning that the monetary system that featured the dollar had been destroyed by Nixon, but the dollar has been able to hang on as the main means of international payment. Something like two-thirds of the world's central bank reserves are in dollars, and that's still something like $2 to $3 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the question of oil and raw materials is linked to the question of the dominant currency in the world. I mean, it should be intuitive. If you have the dominant currency in the world, you're going to be the dominant power in the world. For example, the convention has been, in most cases anyway, until quite recently, that if you wanted oil, you had to have dollars to pay for it.
Correct.
Meaning that it didn't matter who nominally owned the oil or who had nationalized the oil, mm-hmm. was whoever controlled the dollars controlled the access to the oil, meaning the euro-dollar market in London and the Wall Street banks themselves. And this goes through many, many other raw materials. It goes through the international lending agencies. Now you got a situation where China has about $1 trillion, Japan has some fraction of that, but a large fraction, and for the first time, they're going to be able to use euros. They can switch their currency holdings into euros and begin to use them to buy oil, buy and sell oil, because this would be a market. People remember Saddam Hussein switched to euro payments in 2000, I believe, or 2001. North Korea dumped the dollar in favor of the euro around the same time. But this was not a market. This was not a place where you had a spot price for immediate delivery and a futures market going on. It was simply state-to-state deals that you would stipulate with the Iraqi or government or whatever it was at the time. There's also the question that Saddam had changed the oil for food fund into euros, which was about a $15 billion blow for the dollar at the time. It hurt the exchange rate for a while. The British pound, of course, had been the dominant currency in the world from the Napoleonic era to the beginning of World War One, and then it went through these series of collapses in 1914, in 1931, and in 1944. Finally, the dollar was in there, but the British pound still had the secondary role. And the end of the secondary role of the British pound as a reserve currency was when Saudi Arabia said to them, we don't want pounds anymore in payment for our oil. So now it's a big difference, because it's anybody from any part of the world. Chinese can come, Venezuelans can come. You can buy oil, you can sell oil, you can have a futures market, and that becomes the beginning of an alternate world monetary system. In other words, it becomes a division of the world into the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the dollar on one side, and then something with the European Central Bank, the euro, and the oil bourse on the other. Now, of course, the European Central Bank is an obscenity. It's a monstrosity. It's as oligarchical as the Federal Reserve. But just the fact of having two is a step forward, I would say. I think this is what the U.S. and the British, the neocons in particular, are really concerned about with Iran, because you look at these alleged programs, right? Well, what's the most the programs could create? It would be one or two nuclear devices, not even transportable bombs, within some years.
Mm-hmm.
What's the big deal? I think it's trivial.
Mm-hmm.
You can have power reactors. Well, that's fine. That gives you electricity. But the ultimate thing is this Iranian oil bourse or oil exchange. Because that's world strategic.
Some people have tried to diminish that as the key cog in this entire juggernaut toward war, but I concur with you, Webster. It is anything but. All right, we'll be back with more with Webster Griffin Tarpley in just a couple minutes. I'm Jeff Rentz with Webster Griffin Tarpley. We're talking about Iran, not Iran. Iran. Go ahead, Webster.
Well, I'd be interested to know what the objections would be to the key role of this Iranian oil bourse, because to me it seems to be the one most important consideration, again, compared to a couple of crude, primitive nuclear devices that can hardly even be transported.
I agree. Our friend in Venezuela is also accepting euros as payment, I understand, too.
He's accepting euros for payment, but he doesn't have a market. See, this is the big difference. It's not like Venezuela has an exchange where you can go and buy oil futures or sell oil for delivery in a week or two or whatever it is.
Not yet.
The different countries, and well, he's tried to do just about everything in order to get out of the dollar, including barter deals. But the question is, the Iranian one would fill the bill. And of course, if you have the Iranian one, you might want to have others in different parts of the world.
Yes.
Right now, it's a U.S.-British monopoly. You have the New York Mercantile Exchange, where transactions are in dollars. You have the International Petroleum Exchange in London, transactions are in dollars. And then in Tokyo, there's a branch of the New York Mercantile Exchange, transactions also in dollars. So the bottom line is, if you want oil, you have to get dollars, unless you're willing to do one of these state-to-state deals with Iran or Venezuela or whoever it is. But again, the big question, if you want to have a liquid market and you want to prepare an alternative to the dollar as a world reserve currency, there's got to be a euro-denominated market where you can do these things. The other thing about it is that I think is very important. We mentioned these central bank reserves. Something like $2 trillion to $3 trillion are the reserves of the world central banks. And I would say probably two-thirds of that is still in dollars. If you have an Iranian oil market, exchange, bourse, this is the possibility that, say, a half or a third of world central bank reserves will leave the dollar at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say it's a drain of $1 trillion out of the dollar.
Right.
That is an extremely significant thing. This is an economy, of course, built on bubbles. We have a housing bubble that has been going on. Greenspan actually concocted the dot-com bubble. To get out of the Asian contagion, he concocted the dot-com bubble. And to survive the dot-com bubble, he concocted the housing bubble. The housing bubble now shows signs of breaking down. We have a stock market bubble. These valuations are absolutely unrealistic.
Yep.
And above all, we have a dollar bubble. As Mahathir Mohamad of Malaysia has said for many years, the only thing holding up the dollar is the gullibility and cowardice of people around the world who continue to accept it and let this dictate the economic nature of their lives. So I think we could see, if you had the central banks taking a significant portion of their reserves out of the dollar into the euro, into the yen, into gold, into other things, that could really deflate all these bubbles. You've also got the complication. Bush tried last year to loot Social Security. He wanted to convoy all of the Social Security payments into the stock market bubble, and he was trying to hold up the dollar bubble and the housing bubble with that. And it hasn't worked, and I think it may now be too late, because that was the goal of it. So now we're going to have the leading edge of the baby boomers reaching the pre-retirement point where they're no longer going to be pouring money into mutual funds and stocks every week or every month when they get paid, or every 2 weeks, but now they're going to become net sellers of stocks and mutual funds. And that's going to downdraft these markets in ways that you haven't seen in a very, very long time, because the reality of the past 20 or 30 years has been 401ks, IRAs, and the rest of that. So now, just at the moment where the baby boom updraft is ceasing, there's the potential to move all of these assets out of the central bank's dollar account and into the euro account or the yen account. And I think that would then cause tremendous dislocations. I think probably the most eloquent proof that this is the main reason is that they never mention it. Condoleezza Rice, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Bush.
Not a word, you're right.
They've never said it. Hadley.
There you go.
They never say it. And they never said it vis-a-vis Iraq. And, of course, in the case of Iraq, what they did, one of the things very high on Bremer's list when he became proconsul was all oil payments are going to be in dollars once again, and all Iraqi assets are going to be held in dollars.
That's a key observation, Webster. Key. Nobody talks about it. It's a lie of omission. It points in huge neon letters, this way.
And not only do the elected officials and the bankers never talk about it, but even the press never talks about it. Most people are absolutely unaware of this. And you can count, I think, on the fingers of one hand the websites that have even had anything about this. So I think that's extremely suspicious. And again, the question is world domination. If you're going to dominate the world, especially in the U.S.-British mode, that's got to be done through controlling the reserve currency. The way out of this, I think, for the world would be an equitable arrangement, would be the dollar, the euro, and the yen in some kind of a fixed parity relation, so
right.
that we could decrease the uncertainty and the speculative aspect of international trade.
Chinese would like that.
Good, and they should participate, and they should have a fair value for their currency.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea then would be that these currencies would have a fixed parity, and they would have gold settlement. In other words, they would use gold to settle imbalances at the end of a trading period.
Sure. Now, let's go to strategic issues. China has a $200 to $400 billion deal with Iran for natural gas. The Russians have a multitude of deals with the Iranians to build four or five at least more nuclear power plants. They've got deals for oil. They've got a lot of things on the line as well. Now, to somehow divest the interests of Russia and China from Iran, there would have to be some pretty enormous concessions and deals made behind closed doors. I am told that Putin has been given one of the major oil fields in Iraq to allegedly make up for the deal he had with Saddam Hussein, which went by the boards when Bush invaded. It could be that China has been guaranteed natural gas at a different price level or something after an Iranian invasion. There could be deals underway. If not, well, let me put it this way. If there is no military reaction on the part of Russia and or China in the event of an invasion, I would submit that there have been deals made. I don't know how else to read it.
It'd be quite possible. We just have to remember there are 3,700 Russian experts in Iran, as far as I know.
A lot of them would be killed.
And some of them would die.
Yeah, that's right.
Maybe the deals won't hold. But then I think there's a larger consideration when we come back.
And talk about that. Fascinating analysis. All right, let's look at the strategics of this a little bit more. Go ahead.
Maybe just a quick step back to the Iranian oil burst. There were maybe two more things before we get to Putin and Iran. One thing is, if the dollar is dumped, that's going to lead to a lot of countries like China coming forward, say, with $100 billion of treasury bonds or $300 billion and going to the Federal Reserve and saying, we want cash for this. Bernanke has set up the Federal Reserve now for stealth hyperinflation, because there used to be this data series called the M3 money supply. And that will no longer be published as of March. So they'll be able to hyperinflate, and at the beginning, you won't know it. It'll look like a very nice world where the stock market seems to be going up rather rapidly. And it will be hyperinflation, but we won't know it because the M3 data series, the one that would reflect a massive monetization of debt or turning of treasury bonds into newly printed cash, that would no longer show up. That's one thing. The other thing is, when you talk about this, a lot of people get scared and they say, wait a minute, that's our dollar, our purchasing power. And all I can say to that is, you have the U.S. economy today as the buyer of last resort, the dumping ground of all unwanted merchandise in the world, a country that doesn't have to export. Everybody else in the world has got to export products to earn foreign exchange to buy imports. The U.S. doesn't. And that is why we have now a low-wage economy, the standard of living cut in half, and no relevant economic future for a lot of the younger generation. If you didn't have this strange, anomalous, unique role of the dollar, the U.S. ruling elite would have to build factories, put people to work in real jobs with real wages, and export things so that they could buy what they need. The other thing is the whole defense budget. If you look at the $725 billion trade deficit, that pretty much matches up with the defense budget. So, in effect, the outside world is paying for the cost of this bloated Pentagon budget and all the destruction that goes with that. So nobody should feel that they're somehow part of the dollar or they depend on the dollar or that's your purchasing power. It's nothing of the kind. Your purchasing power goes down with the dollar as it is now rather than up. So I think this is important for people to know. Now, concerning Iran, where we were, the question of what's Putin going to do about Iran, I think Putin is going to do as much as he can. On the other hand, if you get down to a situation where it's either the Anglo-Americans are going to attack Iran or they're going to attack Russia first, Putin would rather see them attack Iran first. He can't be more Iranian than he is Russian, right? He's a Russian, after all. The Iranians would have ways to perhaps lower their level of danger, and part of that implied this the deal that Putin offered Iran, which was a real one, that the uranium enrichment would take place on Russian territory, and the Iranians could get around it that way, which would have essentially given them a fig leaf for whatever they wanted to do, and delay the crisis and essentially destroy Bush's and Blair's diplomacy. Now, the Iranians, I think, their leadership is not good. Ahmadinejad is not good. I think Ahmadinejad is a fool. He shoots his mouth off. He's a very precious asset for the U.S. and the British and the Israelis, because without his crazy statements, there were a lot of this ammunition simply wouldn't be there. I will say in Ahmadinejad's defense, he threatens other countries. He threatens to wipe out Israel. Of course, Israel has repeatedly threatened to wipe out Iran. The U.S. and the British have threatened to wipe out Iran. Even Chirac of France has threatened a nuclear bombing of Iran. So we have to have this principle of reciprocity. But I think Putin's view of the matter is, if the U.S. and the British are going to attack Iran, then they will become immeasurably weaker in the process, because they will be depriving themselves of all the oil that goes through the Straits of Hormuz, and that will detonate the final act of this massive worldwide devaluation of the dollar. And if you look at the dollar, probably 75-80% of the dollar is fake. It's fictitious capital. And if you had a panic, it would disappear. The dollar would go down whatever it's worth now to about one-fifth or one-fourth or one-tenth. It's hard to say.
All right, so let's talk about the military aspects of this now. Conventional weapons, a mix, where we have open nuclear tactical weapons being used. The depleted uranium aspect is a foregone conclusion, because most of our conventional weapons are DU now. It isn't going to matter if you're dead one way or the other, but this is an issue of nuclear war.
Yes, certainly. And I think that there have been all sorts of reports about this. There are various scenarios. I've seen this guy Safarov, who is the Iranian expert in Moscow, so he's the Russian-based expert used by the Kremlin. We have this Oxford Research Group, I guess it's called. They have a very low estimate. 10,000 people would die in the bombing. I guess there were three phases. We can just tick them off rather quickly. One would be the interdiction of the Straits of Hormuz and the oil traffic in the Persian Gulf. That can be done with missiles. And, of course, even the threat of that tends to drive up the maritime insurance policies to the point where supertankers can't go in the Gulf because it's too expensive. So it's not even a question of physically blocking. It's if the risk goes up enough, it becomes uneconomical, and you cut the oil off that way, I guess, until the price of oil goes up even further, and then it becomes economical again. But anyway, the world cataclysm is to cut the world oil aorta in the Straits of Hormuz. The second thing would be, what can the Iranians do with these medium-range missiles that they have? They undoubtedly have chemical warheads. They use those against Iraq, that Halabja story that Bush always trots out about Saddam using weapons of mass destruction against his own people. I think the smarter view of that is that was an Iranian cyanide-based gas attack. So the Iranians can shoot cyanide gas at Israel, at U.S. bases, at other countries, Saudi Arabia, that they think are complicit. And then, of course, we have the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, right, the Pasdaran, and their allies in Iraq, who could immediately put especially the British forces in southern Iraq, in
where
Basra,
it's been relatively calm,
in an absolutely critical position because of the fact that these British forces are not very numerous and they've mainly subsisted by making deals. Of course, they've abused that hospitality by sending terrorist teams into southern Iran to blow up oil refineries and so forth. And a trial of those British-backed terrorists is going to begin quite soon. So I think it's mainly the effect in Iraq, the very, very tremendous blowback against the British and U.S. forces when all the Shiites begin to pile on, in addition to the Sunnis that you've had so far, the Straits of Hormuz, and then the missiles and whatever else they can do in terms of longer-range stuff. We have to remember, Iran is three times as large in population, four times as large in area as Iraq, and a lot of it is very rugged, mountainous territory, so not the easy targets in the flat desert of Iraq, necessarily.
And you'll notice how the lapdog media, the controlled, manipulative press of the globalist oligarchs, immediately began to condemn Iran when it said it would retaliate if it was attacked, like there's something wrong with that? I mean,
well,
it's pretty damn funny.
Everybody has the right to self-defense under the UN Charter.
It used to be that way, didn't it?
And yes, you have under natural law, the highest that we can know, everybody has a natural inherent right to self-defense, and you have to assume that this is going to come about. So what it leads to is the U.S. And the British and the Israelis in some combination carrying out nuclear bombardment, conventional bombardment, and then something like a punitive expedition that is raids lasting, you know, maybe several days in various parts of Iran, trying to kill scientists, destroy laboratories, bomb the place back into the Stone Age, but then also send in these paratrooper or special forces teams to go into underground complexes and blow things up that cannot be reached from above or cannot be identified from above. But the problem with all that, and I think that's the useful thing in this report from today, from the Oxford Research Group, which is some kind of a British think tank, I think their estimate of 10,000 civilian casualties is very low. They point to the fact that one of the main purposes of the punitive expedition will be to kill Iranian scientists. In other words, a massacre of scientific manpower that ultimately the world needs and Iran needs,
right.
But they're going to die.
Well, let's not forget how many scientists have been killed in Iraq.
And, of course, a lot of them have been assassinated, right, in Europe. If you were an Arab scientist in Europe, then you're a target of any number of intelligence agencies, including the obvious ones. But the Oxford Research Group in their report today points to the fact that the Iranian war is inherently without end because the country cannot be occupied. The nuclear programs will go on. There will be no negotiations after such an attack. So what it leads to is it's the endless war, I guess, that the neocons seem to be striving for, because this one really will be endless, because there is no possible military way to put an end to resistance.
Correct. Whereas we can't do it in Iraq. Come on. And if the Iranians are attacked, all hell is going to break loose in Iraq.
And this even means that there is no realistic perspective of even occupying Iran,
no.
Quite apart from the
just
extinguishing the resistance.
Nuking it, maybe carving out the oil fields and the gas fields in the lower left third or quarter of the country with some kind
right.
of presence.
Right.
German soldiers, French soldiers, who knows, taking the heart of Iran's economy.
Now, I would also say, concerning those NATO allies, I think ultimately this would be the end of NATO in a relatively short period of time. What it's going to be is something like the Suez Crisis of 1956. In other words, if Merkel thinks she can send German troops to fight in Iran, her government will fall. Same thing will happen in France. Same thing will happen in most of the other ones.
Italy. I agree with you. I do agree. I think
they will fall. NATO will be dead, but that won't stop the war. That will come afterwards. That'll be a matter of a couple of months or weeks after the attack.
Interesting stuff. Our three with Jeff Rentz and Webster Griffin Tarpley are our special guests tonight, talking about the Middle East, Iran, and the big picture, the great game underway. We've been able to draw through Webster's mind's eye, his brilliant scholarship, a very clear picture of the major players and forces at work in this. Talked a bit about the strategic issue of the actual military attack, when and if it comes, which many people predict will be March, some say on the very day of Israel's national elections. I don't know what to think. I think there are still wild cards here that maybe none of us can even imagine. There are always, things never go the way you plan them in battle, in war. It doesn't matter what it is. There are always surprises, screw-ups, people misinterpret. There are unplanned-for contingencies which pop up. There are mistakes. There are all kinds of things, and even the best-laid plans of the rape and pillage of a country like Iran can go awry, and can go terribly awry and very quickly. You never know.
I agree, and one of the lessons of all wars is, among other things, never sit there and wait for some oligarch to attack you according to his plan.
True.
You got to do something to knock him off balance. Now, with Putin again, I think Putin is doing the best he can, more or less. He may have been offered incentives not to join the cause of Iran. I don't think he's going to join the cause of Iran. He's a Russian nationalist, and he's going to realize that if the U.S. attacks Iran, that will keep the U.S. busy for another year or two. the U.S. will be immensely weakened. It may, again, be the final blow to the dollar system, one way or the other, either in an orderly way, perhaps through the oil market, or the disorderly way with the interdiction of the oil through Hormuz and the Persian Gulf. So Putin is, he's shown, I think, a minimum goodwill by this, the invitation of Hamas to Moscow shows that he's still fighting. He hasn't given up by any means. Also, if you go to Pravda RU, you'll find five or six scenarios how Putin can legally stay as president of Russia. There are quite a few. One of them is the long-awaited union of Russia and Belarus, the reunion of White Russia with Great Russia, would create, in effect, a new country, and Putin could become the prime minister of that rather than the president with a new constitution. So this could be done. The other thing with Putin, though, I would like to point to, and maybe people saw this, because I know you were the first one, I think, in the Western or in the North America to have this up. General Leonid Ivashov, my dear friend from Brussels last November, put out this statement. I think when Ivashov speaks, you have to see that this somehow reflects the thinking of the circles around Putin, or it may be Putin himself speaking in a certain way, right? That's how I would look at it. Ivashov was a four-star Russian general, colonel general, nothing higher than that except for a full marshal. And I met him in Brussels last November 17th and 18th at the Axis of Peace conference of Thierry Meyssan of the Voltaire Network. And then this release went around the world that showed me sitting next to him. That was my honor of sitting next to him at this conference in Brussels. And I would just like to point to what Ivashov is talking about. And I think this is very much to the point. He's talking about 9/11. And I think this is, in a way, Putin and others putting forward 9/11 as an issue that could still do what you say. It could still upset the apple cart of the neocons and the Bushies. If you don't mind, maybe I just cite a couple of points from this essay.
No, I'd like to hear that.
He put out. I thought this was very, very important, and above all, a big political signal that I think people needed to pay a great deal of attention to. So here it is, Ivashov, just a couple of things about who he is. He was, back in the spring of 1999, one of the heads of the Russian military establishment. He was one of the people who objected when the U.S. bombed Serbia with this immense vandalism. When the Serbs sued for peace, it was clear that NATO was going to occupy the province of Kosovo. In the north of Kosovo was this airport, Pristina, which was the big airport in that part of the country.
Yep.
And the Russians had asked, politely, we would like a zone of occupation. We would like to create a kind of a safe haven in northern Kosovo around Pristina, which could be a safe haven for Serbian refugees, who otherwise are risking ethnic liquidation themselves. And the U.S. said, no. Wesley Clark, of course, Michael Moore's favorite candidate for president, said no.
Please.
So what Ivashov then did was to take these Russian forces that had been in Bosnia with the I-4 at the UN peacekeeping force and send them to seize the airport at Pristina. And this is when Wesley Clark, again, Michael Moore's favorite politician, said to the ground troop commander was General Sir Michael Jackson of the British, you kicked the Russians out of that airport. And the word came back from Sir Michael Jackson, the famous quote, I'm not starting World War III for you. So this is all Ivashov. So I remember how refreshing it was to see the Russians show some fight back there.
It sent ripples throughout all who think here in the West that, gee whiz, maybe there's another player on the block.
Yes, and I think it's very, very refreshing. Anyway, that's the kind of thinker Ivashov is. So maybe this is... Maybe this little essay of his is to be seen in the same kind of a tradition, right? Trying to do something that will, you know, open up some new perspectives. Anyway, what he says about this, he wants to write about September 11, 2001. His title is International Terrorism Does Not Exist. What he means is as an independent social phenomenon. Maybe as we go through, I can take the liberty of translating some of this into a terminology that might be more familiar to people. He says that terrorism grows out of cynicism, nihilism and globalization. And I think this is absolutely right. The nihilism in particular is the nihilism of the neocons, right? We know that the neocon guru, Leo Strauss, is this guy who writes about the nihilistic revolution. If you're faced by peace, progress, prosperity, equality for everybody, then you've got to avoid that at all costs. You've got to wage the nihilistic revolution and take society back to the Stone Age, quite literally. And then globalization, right? That the world was wrecked by globalization before it was destroyed by 9/11 and the war on terrorism and so forth. He says the people behind this are a global oligarchy who wish to bring about a unipolar world in which they are going to be the new world elite. This elite is the ideologist and godfather of terrorism, and the nature of their of the what the oligarchs want to do is to wage war against reality, against historical, cultural, traditional, and natural reality. And in the process, they want to destroy whole nations and destroy their cultural heritage. So I think this is all very much on target. The terrorists, terrorism as a weapon is a new type of war, and it's indispensable to have the media because they are the manager of global processes. And then, interesting, he wants to point out, where does terrorism come from ultimately? Well, it's people in political and business circles who are interested in destabilizing the world order and had the means necessary to finance this. The political conception of this action, he writes, matured there where tensions emerged in the administration of financial and other types of resources. Now, maybe this is not the best rendering from the Russian, but I think what he's saying is where the dollar crisis and the banking crisis were concentrated, that's where it came forward. So again, it's what's the direction of globalization? Now,
right.
He has three findings, I guess. One is that the secret intelligence agencies and their current or retired chiefs are the only ones who could have done this. Only they have the ability to plan, organize, and conduct an operation on this scale. Secret intelligence agencies create, finance, and control extremist organizations. Without the support of secret services, these terrorist organizations cannot exist, let alone carry out operations of such magnitude inside countries so well protected. So I think that's really fundamental. Another point, Osama bin Laden and, quote, Al-Qaeda, unquote, cannot be, simply cannot be, the organizers and the performers of the September 11th attacks. They do not have the necessary organization, resources, and leaders. What you have is a team of professionals who carried it out. This is, again, I like this because it's close to my terminology, moles, patsies, and professionals. A team of professionals had to be created. The Arab kamikazes are simply extras who are sent in to mask the operation. The whole purpose of this was to reorder world affairs according to the needs of the international oligarchs. So the organizers are the political and business circles. The secret intelligence agencies carried it out, and it can't be bin Laden and Al-Qaeda.
No. No, they just... suckered frontmen is what they were, so to speak. Okay, and we're back. Webster Griffin Tarpley. So, again, we've talked about Iraq, what would happen if Iran is attacked. You can rest assured that Iran would issue orders that revenge at all costs be taken, undertaken against all the invaders in Iraq. It won't get better. I don't know what kind of retaliation to expect from Iran. There are some pretty interesting scenarios laid out there about their sunburn missiles, what they could do to the American nuclear fleet if it is in the, certainly in the Persian Gulf, which apparently one nuclear carrier is. The Straits of Hormuz would obviously be a target. But we don't get much of our oil from the Middle East. Americans don't understand that. I think it's less than 10%, isn't it, Webster?
Well, I don't know the percentage, but I think it's safe to say that the big losers in the Straits of Hormuz would be Europe. Japan.
Sure.
The U.S. can limp along with Venezuela and Nigeria and a couple of others.
And
but
quite frankly, its own enormous reserves, which have been a very big national security secret for decades.
Yes, I think so. I would share that at least as a general direction. But what you're left with then is a price, which makes economic activity impossible.
They'll screw us every which way they
can. And you've also got to remember that since nothing is manufactured here anymore, if Europe and Japan go under, then there's nothing left. And
we'll have to ship our oil over to China so Walmart can stay in business.
So we have all that. Now, just before we leave Ivashov, let me just, what he recommends, I mean, he's picked September 11th as a topic for specific reasons. He recommends attention for the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Now, this is another thing, kind of like the Iran oil bourse. Most of the media have never mentioned it, right? Condoleezza Rice has never talked about it. You've never heard Bush railing against the Shanghai Cooperation Organization.
No, I haven't heard a word about it.
But it is the alternate pole in the world. It's Russia, China, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Iran is applying for membership, and India had been seriously interested. The problem with India is now with the Iranian nuclear crisis, the Indians have been put under a great deal of pressure because, of course, the Indians are the prime case of another country that has become a nuclear power in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and of course, the U.S. and the British don't care about that. But what Ivashov says is, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization could be the seed crystal of a worldwide alternative with a different set of values. In other words, not the monetarism and free trade, free market, globaloney of the Atlanticists. It could have a new strategy for the economic development of nations, a system of international security, and a different financial and economic model. This ultimately would imply a monetary system, some kind of an international lending mechanism for economic development, some kind of equivalent to the World Bank or World Development Bank or International Development Bank or whatever you'd want to call it, so that the world, says Ivashov, would once again not be unipolar but have two pillars. And I would really agree with that. Two pillars, no matter how imperfect the other pillar might be, would be vast progress compared to this single superpower model. I mean, demagogic and false as that is, but still that's the impression people have. He also calls for scientific elites to meet and discuss the situation of the human being in the 21st century. I take it that would be an attack on the war of civilizations, and also that there should be something among religious denominations for development, security, mutual support. In other words, another way to attack the war of civilizations. Now, what I get out of this is that Putin's circle is essentially telling us here in the West, make the September 11th issue explode. And I think that's the conclusion of just about everything that we've said here tonight. And it's what I personally believe in very deeply. We've just had Karl Rove, in case there was ever any question about it, in the speech that he gave to that winter meeting of the Republican National Committee there in early January. Karl Rove came out and said, the basis of the Bush administration and the Republican congressional majority for the entire year of 2006 is going to be September 11th. That the Democrats, of course, have a pre-9/11 mentality, but it's only the Republicans, Bush, his confederates, his cohorts, who have the full understanding of the September 11th world. It's like it used to be you'd have BC and AD, but now we have pre-September 11th, and those were the old days, and now we have post-September 11th, and that's going to be ruled by Bush. It couldn't be any clearer that they don't have an argument about Iraq. They don't really have an argument about Iran. They don't have an argument about the oil bourse. They never mention it, or about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, because they never mentioned that one either. Right. And these are the big things going on in the world. All they have is September 11th, again and again, September 11th, lessons of terrorism, and again and again. Why is there wiretapping? Why the NSA? Why the black sites? Why torture? Why Abu Ghraib? September 11th. Why do we have Abramov? September 11th. Mm-hmm. And on and on and on. So, to me, this is the outcome. In other words, if you want to do something to stop the war with Iran, it's useful to go out and talk about the war with Iran, but it comes down to this. Bush is able to do what he does because there are about 30-40% or 35-40% of the U.S. population who find the 9/11 myth compelling. And it seems to me the question is, how do you attrit that? How do you erode it?
30-40%.
Yeah, that's his. It seems
his
to be
base.
An irreducible base, because
yeah.
Right now he's about 38%. So something in there.
Pretty scary. That many people uninformed, not wanting to know, brainwashed, programmed. Hook, line, and sinker. 40% of America. Could be higher, could be lower. It's a pretty big base, though. Yes, conflict in the United States. A real possibility. Back in a minute. Webster, assuming there is an attack on Iran, and it does appear there will be, what do you think the American public is going to do by way of reaction if we've got a 40% solid rah-rah base for the Bush-Cheney god-awful cartel, and the rest of us at least subconsciously know something is terribly wrong? What do you think when, of course, we, the 60%, will have no access to the mainstream media? They may throw us a bone here and there, but that's about it. What do you think is going to happen here?
I think it's more interesting to see what you could do about it in the meantime, because once it's happened, especially you get the new 9/11, synthetic terrorism, set up by Cheney,
it won't be
and
home,
then the attack,
be a, yeah.
then you're in a whole different world.
Right.
I would try to just focus what I think are very real options left in the pre-Iran world, which I think is going to essentially be the main issue.
Right.
Bush builds his house on September 11th. Karl Rove has told us again. The government, the Republican Party, the regime, everything, the social order, all depends on September 11th. Notice also the role of Hillary Clinton, whose function it is to come out and say, I am more devoted to September 11th than Bush.
Oh,
I can wage war better in Iraq, and when it concludes, in Iran, because she says, I'm going to be out in front. Bush is too passive on Iran. In other words, she's just saying, you know, if I had been president, I would have attacked already. So the Democratic Party, of course, they're absolute accomplices in this stuff, because they have been briefed on all this stuff
right.
just the same way that anybody
and
in the
poor, dumb Americans still think it's a two-party system.
Well, all right. But now, let's look. Where could limited forces make a difference, say, in the next month? Because that's what you're down to. You have some things going on, right? There's a new group called 9/11 Scholars for 9/11 Truth. I recommend it. I'm a member of that.
Right, right.
There's going to be a demonstration on March 20th in New York City. Greg Nixon and some others are organizing what I think is a long overdue notion. It's a protest against the left gatekeepers. And maybe we just take a look at this. There's a body of opinion or a kind of a stratum in the public world of this country. We could call them the left liberals or the radical liberals.
Mm-hmm.
And the common denominator of these people is that they don't like the Iraq war, but their position seems to be Bush was a liar before September 11th. Then after September 11th, through the mysterious agency of the Holy Ghost or whatever it was, Bush told the truth for several weeks. But then he went back to becoming a liar again when he wanted to attack Iraq. And I'm sure when we get now Iran, they're going to say that he was miraculously transformed. These people, you can look. Who are they? Right. The biggest one, the most typical, is Noam Chomsky. Michael Moore. We've had occasion to mention him. Right. Michael Moore, probably the guy who left you in the dark on 9/11 in his documentary film Fahrenheit. 9/11. Greg Palast, Arundhati Roy, very distinguished Indian writer and anti-globalist, leading leftist, won't touch 9/11. None of them will touch 9/11. Gore Vidal, novelist, man
okay,
of letters.
Excuse me, but the obvious question for our listeners who may not be able to follow this, and it's a little tricky, why won't they?
There are many reasons. Noam Chomsky has an institute at Massachusetts Institute of Technology where he's a linguist. I would condemn him as a linguist. He's a linguist in the tradition of Descartes, and I think this is philosophically bad. But the fact is, that institute gets all kinds of money from the Pentagon. Michael Moore is somebody who wants $35,000 to show up at a college for a one-hour appearance, and that's how he makes a lot of money.
Oh,
Greg Palast was on the BBC. I think he's found something in the U.S. Arundhati Roy, I don't know. I'll give you some other examples. Amy Goodman, Democracy Now.
No, she won't touch it. She won't go near it. And all of her sycophants and friends and fans are afraid to point that out.
Yeah, and they have to point it out because she gets money from the Ford Foundation, it is said. You have some academics. Some of these people are have tenure or they're retired, so I don't know what they're...
Retarded, was that? Oh.
Retired. Howard Zinn is a fine person. He won't touch 9/11. Harold Pinter made a great speech when they gave him the Nobel Prize for Literature. Yeah. Didn't crack open the 9/11 issue. George Galloway did a great debate with that thug in the Senate.
Guy ripped him up.
But won't touch 9/11. And he also tells what a great guy he is and how the Palestinians love him. I'm sure they'd love him more if he took down the 9/11 issue. Norman Solomon does a lot of useful work, won't touch 9/11. Anthony Wedgwood Benn, the grand old man of the British Labour Party left, won't touch 9/11. The Nation magazine, Katrina Vandenheuvel, and the Limousine Liberals, they have all sorts of good things, interesting things to say about various issues, pro and con, won't touch 9/11. Mother Jones, won't touch 9/11. The American Prospect, I think it's called, Counterpunch. You can just go through a whole list of left liberals, radical liberals. These people, to me, hold the key. Because if you had Noam Chomsky and the rest of these people, Noam Chomsky is in some ways the biggest name of the crew. If they came out tomorrow morning and said, oh, we've concluded that 9/11 was an inside job. Al-Qaeda were patsies and couldn't do it. The air defense was suppressed by moles. The buildings were, the Twin Towers were brought down in Tower 7 by controlled demolition. A cruise missile hit the Pentagon. And this was done under cover of various U.S. military maneuvers and conduited through the Pentagon, the CIA, the NSA, the DIA, and the rest of it.
One good paragraph is all I'd have to say.
This would essentially open the mind of about 2 to 3 million people.
Agreed.
Who would then, and with that, you would be able to then get into the 35% to 40% of Bush's base. Because the point is, the people in Bush's base, what is their story? They're terrified. Bush says he's going to protect them. These are ignorant little people who don't understand the world. He gives them the pseudo-analysis in sound bites. Fox News comes running. We have the fascist parrots of the afternoon, the Limbaughs and Hannitys and the rest of them, and then the even more extreme fascists like Savage. These people are they're cared for in this sense. In other words, their ideological state is perpetuated by this kind of fascist propaganda, racism, glorification of violence, and so forth. The point is, how do you reach them? The only way you can do this is by exploding the 9/11 myth, by deconstructing it, right? Taking it down. You've got to get to the demontage of the myth. It won't do any good to protest Iraq because they think Iraq is justified based on 9/11. That's what Bush tells them. There's no good saying, you know, watch out, don't go into Iran. They'll say, we have to, otherwise new 9/11. And, of course, you can see that with, you know, the story about the Library Tower, which then became the Liberty Tower, in Bush's latest number there on television.
Unreal.
This is kept alive by a constant drip, drip, drip of scary stories.
Now, repetition.
Bin Laden tapes, Zawahiri tapes, and the rest of it.
It's true. You've just summed it up in 5 minutes brilliantly. And if any one of those people you name would simply come out with that, it would begin, perhaps, since it's wintertime, a snowball. I don't know how big the snowball would get, but no, you're right. One paragraph. I think your point about Noam Chomsky, Amy Goodman especially, and this has been written about before. A lot of these people are tied to grants, folks. Grants, remember that. And the grants come from them. Hence the silence. Be right back. Back with Webster Griffin Tarpley, another institution that has gotten... light years too much credit is this Air America? police.
Well, I have to tell you what one of their personalities, Randy Rhodes, did for me was she announced on the radio that I was dead. I wrote her a letter saying, look, now that you pronounced me dead, could you please revive me and let me come on your show?
Jeez.
And no answer. I think there is one other name I want to include, and it's the most insidious of all of these left border guards and gatekeepers. It's Ward Churchill, the self-styled American Indian at the University of Colorado. He is the one, you'll recall, who got to be famous because he wrote this obscure article saying the people who died in the World Trade Center on September 11th were the little Eichmanns, the little war criminals, the Adolf Eichmanns of U.S. Imperialism. Mm. And at that point, he was on O'Reilly Factor every night for 3 months, and he was on the Hannity Tonight. David Horowitz, the right-wing provocateur, has written a story about professors that he doesn't like, and the leading one is Ward Churchill. Now, Ward Churchill says, if you don't believe the official version recounted by Bush and the FBI and the Kane-Hamilton Commission, then you're a racist. You're a racist because what you're really arguing is that Arabs are inferior beings who are not talented enough to do such a complicated thing. That's the most extreme and the most... I would give him the Arlen Specter Award for the most imaginative, right? Like the magic bullet, right? It's the equivalent of the magic bullet theory to make you believe in 9/11. Excellent. So Ward Churchill is out there. He, of course, what's his background? He claims that he was a terrorist himself, that he came back from Vietnam and taught explosives to the weathermen, who then proceeded to blow up these brownstones in Manhattan. So that's what he says about himself. Some people say it's not true. He's inventing stories like these professors, you know, sometimes do. The one in Amherst who had a whole Vietnam career that never happened. So maybe Ward Churchill's Vietnam career is of the Amherst.
Oh, listen, there were dozens, if not hundreds, of alleged Navy SEALs who were exposed as frauds, too.
Well, so Ward Churchill is somebody of this type. Now, I think that's the most extreme, because he's trying to tell you that you have to believe in the
official
story. That's
pretty wild
story stuff.
I hadn't heard it.
He's the most extreme of all gatekeepers.
Yeah.
But now, I think people are fed up with the gatekeepers. So Greg Nixon, on March 20th, President's Day, I guess, in New York City, and I guess if you Google some of these terms, right, the protest march against left gatekeepers with Greg Nixon in New York City, maybe I can send you some kind of a link. To protest against this.
Because send me a link with their names.
This is essentially he wants to go from the New York Times down to Amy Goodman's famous Firehouse studio, where she holds forth. Now, the limit of respectability for these people is generally, as you pointed out, the limit of foundation funding. In other words, if you go, the oligarchy, there's an oligarchical consensus that the organizing principle of American society for the historical future is the war on terror. That is the purpose of this society. Now, it's as General Ivashov and many others point out, it's insane. Mm-hmm. It's not real. There are even a couple of academics came forward today in some smaller European country saying, wait a minute, you know, when you really add this all up, it doesn't make any sense. Right? It even add the numbers, right? You can compare terrorism deaths to automobile deaths or drug overdoses.
I do that all the time. 45,000 a year. 45,000 a year here in this country.
It's a nightmare. It's insane. Yeah. So there are going to be also demonstrations for the, it's ironic, the third anniversary of the Iraq War is likely to coincide with the beginning of the Iran War.
Oh.
But still, I think it would be good. Some group is organizing a lot of anti-war protests on March 19th, I think it is, or the days right before that. You can look that up, too.
Well, St. Patrick's Day is the 17th. First day of spring is the 20th. Benito Juarez's birthday, whoever the hell that is on the 21st. It's a Mexican holiday.
Oh, he's the Lincoln's ally, president of Mexico, and quite a good fellow, I would say.
Right. Yeah, anyway, that's just... three big days there in a period of five. So.
All right, but I think it would be important, if there are going to be anti-war demonstrations, there should be a big September 11th contingent for people who like to do this. And again, the February 20th march in New York City, there are plans for a larger 9/11 conference in Chicago in early May.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are going to be some events in places like Seattle, that I'm going to one of those. Seattle, I think it's the 31st of March. And then there's one in Burlington, Vermont, coming up sometime in...
You know, their whole plan, of course, is... well, they've always felt this way, and Goebbels proved them right, and they've proved themselves right with time. Time. Replace 9/11 with something just as big in the minds of Americans, and all of a sudden 9/11, like Oklahoma City, like Waco, like Ruby Ridge, like TWA Flight 800, they all begin to diminish and fade. They've got time. They know how to use it. Time. Something more horrible. We don't have a lot of time. What you're saying, Webster, is correct. We've got to do it and do it now before Iran if we're going to do anything.
And again, it's the only way to reach those 35% to 40%. In other words, they have essentially brainwashed themselves.
They're some scary people. Those people have bricks for brains. They're not open, many of them.
But again, I agree with you in condemning them, and I share that.
I'm not
that,
condemning them. I'm just trying to describe them.
But the problem is, look at these people, the Chomskys, the Amy Goodmans, the Greg Pallas, the Michael Moores, the Galloways, the Solomons, the Pinters, and so forth. Haven't they failed in their task as progressive intellectuals, or even the left liberals or radical liberals they claim to be? They have struck out. They have failed everybody worldwide, because Chomsky in particular has a worldwide audience, and so does Arundhati Roy. Their refusal to tackle the hard question, and it's really the only question, because you cannot accept the premise of September 11th and then quarrel with what Bush wants to deduce from that. It just doesn't work. Once you've accepted that universe of discourse, you're lost.
Now you accept the Reichstag fire?
Right. If you accept that the communists did the Reichstag fire, then the path to World War II is open before you, and there's no exit from that particular road.
You know, you summed the whole thing up in that magnificent paragraph before the last break, and if that could be simply written up and given to these people and said, look, you know, here it is. I want a yay or a nay on this. I want a commitment from you. Is it true? Can you subscribe to it or not? And if you can't, why not?
Well, maybe that's an action we ought to undertake.
I love that description that you summed it all up.
Just, if your radio program, if you want to be, you know, there's the O'Reilly challenge going on, right? Maybe you want to have the Rents challenge.
Listen, anybody listening wants to pull that and just send it over to me. I'll send it to Webster. I'll post it, and we'll put a challenge up there on the homepage. These are the people who have to be held to the fire. Now, you're right. They are what is holding up and enlightenment. They're not gatekeepers, because the gates welded shut in many cases.
Well, they're the border. I think in their own minds, they're the border of what is respectable. That is, this would be their rhetorical stance. Up to me and including me is responsible. But if you go beyond me, it's conspiracy,
Kook
paranoia.
Land. Never mind, it's the truth. It's Kookland. Kookland.
Tinfoil hats.
That's right.
But again, conspiracy and paranoia would be the main thing.
And you know, the biggest conspiracy of all is sitting right there at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, and in the Congress, and in the and the Supreme Court now, and those globalist oligarchs who are pulling the strings. That's your conspiracy.
Again, these people, if you ask them, do you believe Bush about the budget? Do you believe Bush about Haiti? Do you believe Bush about National Security Agency wiretaps?
Right.
No. And they would be mortified. They would die of shame if they were found agreeing with Bush on anything, except the one thing that happens to be the most important political issue. And Karl Rove has just told them again that it's the most important political issue, and it's going to be the basis of the campaigns of the year 2006. And he's told them that, and he's saying, this is the basis of our government, our regime. This is our base of 40% of terrified cretins, and what are you going to do about it? And essentially, they're saying, we're not going to do anything about it, because that would make us paranoid conspiracy theorists. We wouldn't be respectable, and our Ford Foundation funding might not come in.
Bush cabal made apparently a move, a PR, a little change in PR tact a little bit, tact and tack. They are apparently going to pull back from using the expression the war on terror. They're calling it the long war now. The long war. I picked that up this morning somewhere.
With Iraq plus Iran plus Syria.
It's the new buzzword. It's the new motto. It's the new cliche for imperialism, the long war. They're not calling it terrorism anymore.
Well, again, for a lot of people, for the 35 to 40%, that is just the way it is. And the only way to alter their view, I fear, is to break into this somehow with the reality. Again, Bush has no arguments for Iraq. He has only 9/11 arguments. There is absolutely no proof that Iran has got any program going to create a nuclear bomb. The International Atomic Energy Agency has argued until now that there is no evidence that any violation of the Nonproliferation Treaty is going on. The only thing there is, as Bush drags out again and again, and the unfortunate Miss Rice, is September 11th. And that after September 11th, you've got to have preemptive attacks, and you can't wait around to see what happens. So again, if you, once you go into that universe of discourse, you're a goner. And that's what these people have chosen to do. They've gone into some kind of grand hotel of the abyss, right, where they sit on the edge and watch it all happen. But I would say challenge them, right, and challenge them with the increased urgency, saying, look, up to now you've been intellectually lazy and dishonest and so forth, but now the question is, do you want to have the war with Iran or not? And that's, of course, much worse.
And not a word about North Korea, who has
And then you'll get that, too. And ultimately, you'll get Russia and China. But by then, the chances will have run out for us.
Indeed. Webster, thank you. Another magnificent presentation, as
always.
Thank
you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and I'm here to help anytime. Thank you.
Good night.
Good night, Webster. Webster Griffin Tarpley. And, boy, you just heard it right there in the last hour especially. Just nailed it. Okay, that's what we like to do here. So, agree or disagree, thanks for opening your mind and taking it all in. And we'll pause for 21 hours and be right back tomorrow night.